The London traffic system is many hundreds of times more complex than anyone imagines. This has nothing to do with influences, demonic or angelic. It's more to do with geography and history and architecture. Mostly, this works to people's advantage, although they'd never believe it. London was not designed for cars. Come to that, it wasn't designed for people. It just sort of happened. This created problems, and the solutions that were implemented became the next problems 5 or 10 or 100 years down the line. The latest solution had been the M25, a motorway that formed a rough circle around the city. Up until now, the problems had been fairly basic, things like it being obsolete before they had finished building it, Einsteinian tailbacks that eventually became tail forwards, that kind of thing. The current problem was that it didn't exist, not in normal human spatial terms anyway. The tailback of cars unaware of this, or trying to find alternate routes out of London, stretched into the city centre from every direction. For the first time ever, London was completely gridlocked. The city was one huge traffic jam. Cars, in theory, give you a terrifically fast method of travelling from place to place. Traffic jams, on the other hand, give you a terrific opportunity to stay still. In the rain and the gloom, while around you the cacophonous symphony of horns grew ever louder and more exasperated. Crowley was getting sick of it. He'd taken the opportunity to reread Aziraphale's notes and to thumb through Agnes Nutter's prophecies and to do some serious thinking. His conclusions could be summarised as follows. 1. Armageddon was underway. 2. There was nothing Crowley could do about this. 3. It was going to happen in Tadfield, or to begin there at any rate. After that, it was going to happen everywhere. 4. Crowley was in hell's bad books, not that hell has any other kind. 5. Aziraphale was, as far as could be estimated, out of the equation. 6. All was black, gloomy, and awful. There was no light at the end of the tunnel, or if there was, it was an oncoming train. 7. He might just as well find a nice little restaurant and get completely and utterly pissed out of his mind while he waited for the world to end. 8. And yet... And that was where it all fell apart, because underneath it all, Crowley was an optimist. If there was one rock-hard certainty that had sustained him through the bad times, he thought briefly of the 14th century, then it was utter surety that he would come out on top, that the universe would look after him. OK, so hell was down on him, so the world was ending, so the Cold War was over and the Great War was starting for real, so the odds against him were higher than a vanload of hippies on a blotter full of Owlsley's old original. There was still a chance. It was all a matter of being in the right place at the right time. The right place was Tadfield, he was certain of that, partly from the book, partly from some other sense. In Crowley's mental map of the world, Tadfield was throbbing like a migraine. The right time was getting there before the end of the world. He checked his watch. He had 2 hours to get to Tadfield, although probably even the normal passage of time was pretty shaky by now. Crowley tossed the book into the passenger seat. Desperate times, desperate measures. He had maintained the Bentley without a scratch for 60 years. What the hell? He reversed suddenly, causing severe damage to the front of the red Renault 5 behind him, and drove up onto the pavement. He turned on his lights and sounded his horn. That should give any pedestrians sufficient warning that he was coming. And if they couldn't get out of the way, well, it'd all be the same in a couple of hours. Maybe. Probably.
Hey-ho,
said Anthony Crowley, and just drove anyway. You wouldn't have known it as the same car. There was scarcely an inch of it undented. Both front lights were smashed. The hubcaps were long gone. It looked like the veteran of 100 demolition derbies. The pavements had been bad. The pedestrian underpass had been worse. The worst bit had been crossing the River Thames, At least he'd had the foresight to roll up all the windows. Still, he was here now. In a few hundred yards, he'd be on the M40, a fairly clear run up to Oxfordshire. There was only one snag. Once more between Crowley and the open road was the M25, a screaming, glowing ribbon of pain and dark light. Not actually an oxymoron, it's the colour past ultraviolet. The technical term for it is infra-black. It can be seen quite easily under experimental conditions. To perform the experiment, simply select a healthy brick wall with a good run-up and, lowering your head, charge. The colour that flashes in bursts behind your eyes, behind the pain, just before you die, is infra-black. Odegra. Nothing could cross it and survive. Nothing mortal, anyway. And he wasn't sure what it would do to a demon. It couldn't kill him, but it wouldn't be pleasant. There was a police roadblock in front of the flyover before him. Burnt-out wrecks, some still burning, testified to the fate of previous cars that had to drive across the flyover above the dark road. The police did not look happy. Crowley shifted down into second gear and gunned the accelerator. He went through the roadblock at 60. That was the easy bit. Cases of spontaneous human combustion are on record all over the world. One minute someone's quite happily chugging along with their life, the next there's a sad photograph of a pile of ashes and a lonely and mysteriously uncharred foot or hand. Cases of spontaneous vehicular combustion are less well documented. Whatever the statistics were, they had just gone up by one. The leather seat covers began to smoke. Staring ahead of him, Crowley fumbled left-handedly on the passenger seat for Agnes Nutter's nice and accurate prophecies, moved it to the safety of his lap. He wished she'd prophesied this. She had. It read, "A street of light will scream, the black chariot of the serpent will flame, and a queen will sing Quicksilver's songs no more." Most of the family had gone along with Galatly Device, who wrote a brief monograph in the 1830s explaining it as a metaphor for the banishment of Weishaupt's Illuminati from Bavaria in 1785. Then the flames engulfed the car. He had to keep driving. On the other side of the flyover was a further police roadblock to prevent the passage of cars trying to come into London. They were laughing about a story that had just come over the radio that a motorbike cop on the M6 had flagged down a stolen police car, only to discover the driver to be a large octopus. Some police forces would believe anything. Not the Metropolitan Police, though. The Met was the hardest, most cynically pragmatic, most stubbornly down-to-earth police force in Britain. It would take a lot to phase a copper from the Met. It would take, for example, a huge battered car that was nothing more nor less than a fireball, a blazing, roaring, twisted metal lemon from hell, driven by a grinning lunatic in sunglasses, sitting amid the flames, trailing thick black smoke, coming straight at them through the lashing rain and the wind at 80 miles per hour. That would do it every time. Look at Crowley, doing 110 miles per hour on the M40, heading toward Oxfordshire. Even the most resolutely casual observer would notice a number of strange things about him. The clenched teeth, for example, or the dull red glow coming from behind his sunglasses. And the car. The car was a definite hint. Crowley had started the journey in his Bentley, and he was damned if he wasn't going to finish it in the Bentley as well. Not that even the kind of car buff who owns his own pair of motoring goggles would have been able to tell it was a vintage Bentley. Not anymore. They wouldn't have been able to tell that it was a Bentley. They would only offer 50-50 that it had ever even been a car. There was no paint left on it for a start. It might still have been black, where it wasn't a rusty, smudged reddish brown, but this was a dull charcoal black. It travelled in its own ball of flame, like a space capsule making a particularly difficult re-entry. There was a thin skin of crusted, melted rubber left around the metal wheel rims, But seeing that the wheel rims were still somehow riding an inch above the road surface, this didn't seem to make an awful lot of difference to the suspension. It should have fallen apart miles back. It was the effort of holding it together that was causing Crowley to grit his teeth, and the biospatial feedback that was causing the bright red eyes. That and the effort of having to remember not to start breathing. He hadn't felt like this since the 14th century. R.P. Tyler, only 10 minutes away from the village, paused while Schutze attempted another of its wide range of eliminatory functions. He gazed over the fence. His knowledge of country law was a little hazy, but he felt fairly sure that if the cows lay down, it meant rain. If they were standing, it would probably be fine. These cows were taking it in turns to execute slow and solemn somersaults, and Tyler wondered what it presaged for the weather. He sniffed. Something was burning. There was an unpleasant smell of scorched metal and rubber and leather.
"Excuse me,"
said a voice from behind him. R.P. Tyler turned around. There was a large, once black car, on fire, in the lane, and a man in sunglasses was leaning out of one window, saying through the smoke,
"I'm sorry, I've managed to get a little lost. Can you direct me to Lower Tadfield Air Base? I know it's around here somewhere."
"Your car is on fire." No, Tyler just couldn't bring himself to say it. I mean, the man had to know that, didn't he? He was sitting in the middle of it. Possibly it was some kind of practical joke. So instead he said,
I think you must have taken a wrong turn about a mile back. A signpost has blown down.
The stranger smiled.
That must be it.
The orange flames flickering below him gave him an almost infernal appearance. The wind blew towards Tyler, across the car, and he felt his eyebrows frizzle. Excuse me, young man, but your car is on fire, and you're sitting in it without burning, and incidentally it's red hot in places. No. Should he ask the man if he wanted him to phone the AA? Instead, he explained the route carefully, trying not to stare.
That's terrific. Much obliged,
said Crowley, as he began to wind up the window. R.P. Tyler had to say something.
Excuse me, young man.
Yes?
I mean, it's not the kind of thing you don't notice, your car being on fire. A tongue of flame licked across the charred dashboard.
Funny weather we're having, isn't it?
Is it? I honestly hadn't noticed.
And he reversed back down the country lane in his burning car.
That's probably because your car is on fire.
He jerked Schutz's lead, dragged the little dog to heel. At the main gate, Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger was also having problems. A little man in a dirty mac kept pointing a finger at him and muttering, while a lady who looked slightly like his mother talked to him in urgent tones and kept interrupting herself in a different voice.
It really is vitally important that we are allowed to speak to whoever is in charge. I really must ask that...
He's right, you know. I'd be able to tell if he was lying.
Yes, thank you. I think we'd really achieve something if you kindly allowed me to carry on, all right? Thank you.
I was only trying to put in a good word.
Yes,
You were asking him to...
Yes, all right. Now.
Do you see my finger?
Shouted Shadwell, whose sanity was still attached to him, but only on the end of a long and rather frayed string.
Do you see it? This finger, laddie, could send you to meet your maker.
Sergeant Deisenberger stared at the black and purple nail a few inches from his face. As an offensive weapon, it rated quite highly, especially if it was ever used in the preparation of food. The telephone gave him nothing but static. He'd been told not to leave his post. His wound from Narm was starting to play up. He'd slipped and fallen in a hotel shower when he took a holiday there in 1983. Now the mere sight of a bar of yellow soap could send him into near-fatal flashbacks. He wondered how much trouble he could get into for shooting non-American civilians. Just to make Sergeant Deisenberger's day, a car pulled up and it was floating several inches off the ground because it had no tyres or paintwork. What it did have was a trail of blue smoke, and when it stopped, it made the pinging noises made by metal cooling down from a very high temperature. It looked as if it had smoked glass windows, although this was just an effect caused by it having ordinary glass windows but a smoke-filled interior. The driver's door opened and a cloud of choking fumes got out. Then Crowley followed it. He waved the smoke away from his face, blinked, and then turned the gesture into a friendly wave.
Hi. How's it going? Has the world ended yet?
He won't let us in, Crowley.
Aziraphale, is that you? Nice dress,
said Crowley vaguely. He wasn't feeling very well. For the last 30 miles, he had been imagining that a ton of burning metal, rubber and leather was a fully functioning automobile, and the Bentley had been resisting him fiercely. The hard part had been to keep the whole thing rolling after the all-weather radials had burned away. Beside him, the remains of the Bentley dropped suddenly onto its distorted wheel rims as he stopped imagining that it had tyres. He patted a metal surface hot enough to fry eggs on.
You wouldn't get that sort of performance out of one of these modern cars.
They stared at him. There was a little electronic click. The gate was rising. The housing that contained the electric motor gave a mechanical groan and then gave up in the face of the unstoppable force acting on the barrier.
Hey! Which one of you yo-yos did that?
Zip, 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 zip.
and a small dog, its legs a blur. They stared at the four ferociously peddling figures that ducked under the barrier and disappeared into the camp. The sergeant pulled himself together.
Hey, did any of them kids have some space alien with a face like a friendly turd in a bike basket?
Don't think so.
Then they're in real trouble.
He raised his gun. Enough of this pussyfooting around. He kept thinking of soap.
And so are you.
I warns ye.
Oh, this has gone on too long. Sort it out, Crowley, there's a dear chap. I'm the nice one. You can't expect me to... Oh, blast it. You try to do the decent thing and where does it get you?
He snapped his fingers. There was a pop, like an old-fashioned flashbulb, and Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger disappeared.
See?
Said Shadwell, who hadn't quite got the hang of Madame Tracy's split personality.
Nothing to it. You stick by me, you'll be all right.
Well done. Never thought you had it in you.
No, nor did I, in fact. I do hope I haven't sent him somewhere dreadful.
You better get used to it right now. You just send them. Best not to worry about where they go.
He looked fascinated.
Aren't you going to introduce me to your new body?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. Madame Tracy, this is Crowley. Crowley, Madame Tracy.
Charmed, I'm sure.
Let's get on in.
He looked sadly at the wreckage of the Bentley and then brightened. A jeep was heading purposefully towards the gate, and it looked as though it was crowded with people who were about to shout questions and fire guns and not worry about which order they did this in. He brightened up. This was more what you might call his area of competence. He took his hands out of his pockets, and he raised them like Bruce Lee, and then he smiled like Lee Van Cleef.
Ah, here comes transport.
Clouds churned around the horizon. Overhead, the sky was still clear, the air torn by nothing more than a light breeze. But it wasn't normal air. It had a crystallized look to it, so that you might feel that if you turned your head, you might see new facets. It sparkled. If you had to find a word to describe it, the word thronged might slip insidiously into your mind. Thronged with insubstantial beings, awaiting only the right moment to become very substantial. Adam glanced up. In one sense, there was just clear air overhead. In another, stretching off to infinity, were the hosts of heaven and hell, wingtip to wingtip. If you looked really closely and had been specially trained, you could tell the difference. Silence held the bubble of the world in its grip. The door of the building swung open and the four stepped out. There was no more than a hint of human about three of them now. They seemed to be humanoid shapes made up of all the things they were or represented. They made death seem positively homely. His leather greatcoat and dark visored helmet had become a cowled robe, but these were mere details. A skeleton, even a walking one, is at least human. Death of a sort lurks inside every living creature.
The thing is, they're not really real. They're just like nightmares, really.
But we're not asleep.
Dog whined and tried to hide behind Adam.
That one looks as if he's melting,
said Brian, pointing at the advancing figure, if such it could still be called, of pollution.
There you are, then. It can't be real, can it? It's common sense. Something like that can't be really real.
The four halted a few metres away.
It has been done.
He leaned forward a little and stared eyelessly at Adam. It was hard to tell if he was surprised.
Yes. Well, the thing is, I don't want it done. I never asked for it to be done.
Death looked at the other three, and then back to Adam. Behind them, a jeep skewed to a halt. They ignored it.
I do not understand. Surely your very existence requires the ending of the world. It is written.
I don't see why anyone has to go and write things like that. The world is full of all sorts of brilliant stuff, and I haven't found out all about it yet. So I don't want anyone messing it about or ending it before I've had a chance to find out about it. So you can all just go away.
That's the one, Mr. Shadwell,
said Aziraphale, his words trailing into uncertainty even as he uttered them.
The one with the T-shirt.
Death stared at Adam.
You are part of us,
said War, between teeth like beautiful bullets.
It is done. We make the world anew,
said Pollution, his voice as insidious as something leaking out of a corroded drum into a water table.
You lead us,
said Famine. And Adam hesitated. Voices inside him still cried out that this was true, and that the world was his as well, and all he had to do was turn and lead them out across a bewildered planet. They were his kind of people. In tiers above, the hosts of the sky waited for the word.
You cannot want me to shoot him. He's but a bairn.
Yes. Perhaps we'd just better wait a bit. What do you think?
Until he grows up, do you mean?
Dog began to growl. Adam looked at the them. They were his kind of people too. You just had to decide who your friends really were. He turned back to the four.
Get them.
The slouch and slur was gone from his voice. It had strange harmonics. No one human could disobey a voice like that. War laughed and looked expectantly at the them.
Little boys playing with your toys. Think of all the toys I can offer you. Think of all the games. I can make you fall in love with me, little boys. Little boys with your little guns.
She laughed again, but the machine gun stutter died away as Pepper stepped forward and raised a trembling arm. It wasn't much of a sword, but it was about the best you could do with two bits of wood and a piece of string. War stared at it.
I see. Mano a mano, huh?
She drew her own blade and brought it up so that it made a noise like a finger being dragged around a wine glass. There was a flash as they connected. Death stared into Adam's eyes. There was a pathetic jingling noise.
Don't touch it,
snapped Adam, without moving his head. The them stared at the sword rocking to a standstill on the concrete path.
Little boys.
Sooner or later, everyone has to decide which gang they belong to.
But, she sort of got sucked up the sword.
The air between Adam and Death began to vibrate, as in a heat wave. Wensleydale raised his head and looked Famine in the sunken eye. He held up something that, with a bit of imagination, could be considered to be a pair of scales made of more string and twigs. Then he whirled it around his head. Famine stuck out a protective arm. There was another flash, and then the jingle of a pair of silver scales bouncing on the ground.
Don't touch them.
Pollution had already started to run, or at least to flow, quickly, but Brian snatched the circle of grass stalks from his own head and flung it. It shouldn't have handled like one, but a force took it out of his hands and it whirred like a discus. This time the explosion was a red flame inside a billow of black smoke, and it smelled of oil. With a rolling, tinny little sound, a blackened silver crown bowled out of the smoke, and then spun round with a noise like a settling penny. At least they needed no warning about touching it. It glistened in a way that metal should not.
Where'd they go?
Where they belong,
said Death, still holding Adam's gaze.
Where they have always been. Back in the minds of man.
He grinned at Adam. There was a tearing sound. Death's robe split and his wings unfolded. Angel's wings, but not of feathers. They were wings of night, wings that were shapes cut through the matter of creation into the darkness underneath, in which a few distant lights glimmered, lights that may have been stars or may have been something entirely else.
But I am not like them. I am Azrael, created to be creation's shadow. You cannot destroy me. That would destroy the world.
The heat of their stare faded. Adam scratched his nose.
Oh, I don't know. There might be a way.
He grinned back.
Anyway, it's going to stop now. All this stuff with the machines. You've got to do what I say, just for now. And I say, it's got to stop.
Death shrugged.
It is stopping already. Without them...
He indicated the pathetic remnants of the other three horsepersons.
It cannot proceed. Normal entropy triumphs.
Death raised a bony hand in what might have been a salute.
They'll be back. They're never far away.
The wings flapped just once like a thunderclap, and the Angel of Death vanished.
Right then,
said Adam to the empty air.
All right. It's not going to happen. All the stuff they started. It must stop now.